SCP-8888 8 Ball Part 4. We're knee-deep in a heist right now, with things about to turn a corner. Dr. Weddle has been providing a great distraction for the library in the middle of the Grand Hall, and Sikolsky, Moncier, and Placeholder are closer than ever to getting the 8 Ball back. It's not over until it's over, however, and like any good heist film, there's still some twists and turns left in store for our crew of misfits. Let's get back into it for the final part of SCP-8888. We pick things up right where we left off, with Dr. Moncier and Placeholder McDoctorate stepping into the lighthouse and walking up to the vault door. The moment they see it, they both gasp, and Sikolsky asks if that's a good gasp. Moncier replies that it's a very good gasp, as she runs her hand reverently over the massive array of ornate clockwork. She says that this is Hero's Engine, but Placeholder says that this isn't, as Hero's Engine is an old-timey turbine. Moncier just shakes her head and says that that's the cover story, as the real one was lost, at least until now, and they wanted to get ahead of the myth. Hero of Alexandria was said to have developed a perfect mechanical lock powered by beryllium bronze clockwork, which is what this is. Hero was also associated with the 8 Ball, where it appears in antiquity, as has the lighthouse and the library in Alexandria. Sikolsky nods and remarks that history repeats, but Moncier corrects him by saying that historians repeat history cycles. Placeholder reaches out to manipulate the device's massive hands, as there are 8 sets in color-coded groups of 3. They turn easily, and the gears sing in their housings as he does so. He explains that the outer dial represents the Jungian archetypes, the inner dial the overseers. One of the middle dials is the Olympic gods, and the other is piss right off. Sikolsky asks if he can figure it out, and Placeholder nods, saying that he thinks someone's been making a few additions to this thing, because he's pretty sure that they didn't have billiards in classical antiquity. There's 15 balls, cue ball included, and there's no points for guessing which one's missing. He pulls the hands into position, naming a member of the heist crew each time he does so. Sikolsky, the ruler, Zeus, cue ball, practician. Moncier, the sage, Apollo, 9 Ball, Oracle. The remainder of the process goes smoothly, with Placeholder identifying Weddle as a joker, for obvious reasons, Sumerian as the humanist for his ethics committee connections, and Hishikaku as an outlaw, for reasons they've all been thinking and frequently speaking aloud. At the moment he manipulates the final hand to identify Agent S as a magician associated with Artemis and 0511, the hands abruptly spin back into place with a machine gun whir, the gears spin madly, a low tone sounds, and the vault door swings open to reveal its contents. Sikolsky breathes out the word fantastic as he strides into the empty vault, pulls a celery stick out of his suit, and begins pointing it at every exposed surface. Placeholder remarks incredulously that it's not here, and Sikolsky replies in an almost giddy tone that, of course it isn't, as that would have been too hard. If you put that much effort into a heist, and Placeholder finishes his sentence excitedly, that you've got to be on the wrong trail. Sikolsky looks down at the celery stick, apparently receiving some sort of readout, and mutters about Sumerian's fingerprints. He remarks that this place looks like it hasn't been opened since 93, and Placeholder asks if this was all for nothing. Moncier says hardly and steps in as she suddenly begins to tremble. Her milky eyes begin to softly glow and she smiles at the other two, but she looks terrified. She tells them that they're very near the foundations of the library. She sees the serpent and it sees her too. Sikolsky just nods and says that he thinks perhaps they had better heist their asses out of this vault. Meanwhile, at Casino Night, things have dissolved into less agreeable chaos. The Serpent's Hand agents are attempting to hold back a flood of angry patrons demanding to cash out their chips, while the under-Vegas bankers consult a massive tome of arcane contractual caveats to escape their now impossible-to-fulfill obligations. Midnight is screaming and yowling at Ball, who is threatening to double-dribble her, and there is a sense of double entendre. Site-666 demonologist Dr. Contessa Thorner, or Two-Ball, is observing altercations between demons and wanderers from a high gallery, and performing triage exorcisms to prevent fatal escalation. The small, furry patron is driving the auto rickshaw in circles through the crowd, while the corpulent, gelatinous form of the demon king Asmodeus is writhing and bellowing wetly as a series of violent ripples pass through his body. He is attempting to smother Agent Callender, and she is pistoning punches at his underbelly and laughing in unrestrained glee. A reporter for the Planisthy Press is interviewing the combatants, occasionally stealing unattended drinks and flinging hexes wherever they seem most likely to generate the best copy for the special edition. A wrath demon pile drives a being of pure electricity into the Under-Vegas camp's Hi-Hi-Fi-Wi router, and it is sucked into the library's Thaumato electrical system. Below, in the underlibrary, the sudden power flicker allows McDoctorate, Monsier, and Sikolsky to escape the locked-down door to the Pharos' chamber. Hand thaumaturges and Under-Vegas witches are streaming into the space, which is expanding rapidly to accommodate its contents. Docents are banishing violators of the library's rules against violence, vandalism, profane speech, and cannibalism at a rate which does little to reduce the scope of the scrum. Dr. Weddle cowers in the center of this activity, suit in tatters, whimpering. Elsewhere in the library, unbeknownst to him, Dr. Cimmerian is about to be discovered by a detachment of Midnight's deputized special librarians, who are responding to both Harkness's disruption of the docent web and Sikolsky's tripping of the security wards in the underlibrary. A sudden shudder passes through the entirety of the library, however, and they stop in their tracks long enough for him to notice them. He ducks into a side passage just as a keening alarum wails from the depths, accompanied by a deafening gong, and a high, chittering voice cries through an invisible public address system. It shouts for a code serpentine, and for all agents to proceed to the Grand Hall by order of the 8th Archivist. The special librarians turn and run in the opposite direction, as Cimmerian slips past, consulting a small object in his hand and nodding. The 8th Archivist of the Wanderer's Library, a massive red and brown arthropod known as the Rounderpede, previously seen on this channel during SCP-6500, crashes through the Arcadia Pachinko Parlor, scattering patrons and balls in every direction in its haste to confront Director House at the Site-666 camp. It screeches at him that he has awoken the serpent, but House, who is presently kicking the toner out of a laser printer, glares at the archivist and says that if that's his professional wrestling entrance, then it sucks. The archivist just roars in frustration and fear, shouting that it's the serpent, and House now realizes what it means, the creator of the Wanderer's Library. The archivist continues shouting, saying that the docents are in an uproar, the librarians are in a tizzy, its carapace is itching, and it's all House's fault. It extends a prehensile tongue out towards House, who bats it away with an extracted toner cartridge, and retorts that they weren't even being that loud, at least before whatever this is. They also had permits, and there was nothing about a noise bylaw in the agreement, as he would have remembered a clause about not waking up primordial entities. The special librarians file into the Grand Hall and begin canceling library cards en masse. Ball immediately responds by opening a Tartarian portal, and the combined might of Python's Spirits of Line and Astaroth's Columinators, the two top-ranked basketball teams of Hell currently, file out, form a phalanx, and begin tackling the special librarians. Sikolsky is the first to escape the underlibrary, emerging onto the ground level and pulling Hishikaku by the ear. As the others join him, Agent S rushes up with a wide grin on her face, stating that this is the best day of her life. Placeholder notes that the distraction seems to be a little too distracting, as the Grand Hall now holds almost the entire active population of the library, and the automatically generated tables and research corrals are being repurposed as barricades and makeshift battle tanks. He asks if Weddle is in there somewhere, and Monsieur just laughs, while Hishikaku shakes himself free from Sokolsky's grip, shouting that they can't get through that, and it's the only way back to Planet Fitness. One of the basketball demons brought a boombox with them, and they have begun blasting Rob Zombie's Dragula on loop, presumably ironically. Sokolsky turns to Agent S and asks if she has any gadgets that can get them through there, to which she just giggles and notes that that's a rhetorical question. The team proceeds to exfiltrate through the center of the Grand Hall, snatching up Dr. Weddle on the way, who is wailing that he doesn't know what's happening. They're inside of the exclusion zone of a gaudy rainbow umbrella that Agent S terms the Foul Weather Friend, and they're almost through the crowd when Weddle's pocket explodes in a flash of green light, throwing them through the catering tables in a hail of devil's food. Several individuals present during Weddle's initial round of distractions, including the man who cut House's comms, the man who returned Weddle's mark of credit, the woman who poured her drink on his head, and the man who embarrassed him at the arcade, assemble from every direction. The woman stops to help Agent S to her feet, and they embrace warmly. Both of the women are weeping openly, and the group standing around them are grinning and holding back tears. Placeholder extricates himself from a pile of blood sausage and asks if that's SCP-040, which Sokolsky confirms, stating that this is the House of Stars. Without getting too much into it, SCP-040 was a young girl that the Foundation recovered from a raid on a school for gifted youth, finding that she possesses the anomalous ability to manipulate the physical characteristics of living organisms. She eventually breached containment at the age of 16 as her powers grew, and shortly thereafter was found to be working with the House of Stars, an old, small group of interest that pulls off heists against anomalous organizations. Hishikaku screams that there's another heist going on, before getting hit in the back of the head with a book thrown from a high gallery by Contessa. The exclusion zone has vanished now, and the chaotic crowd begins closing back in until everything stops. Agent S has produced the heart-shaped padlock, apparently from thin air, and snapped it shut, causing the room to go still. She clears her throat daintily before beginning to speak, addressing the Foundation personnel as the leader of the House of Stars snatches up Weddle's fallen carnation and ambles towards the Site 666 camp. Agent S tells the group that they canceled her childhood, as they couldn't understand her and couldn't control her, so instead they put her in a coma. They did that to a child, and then let some maniac try to murder her. There is a single cough in the distance, as one individual is apparently still moving in the crowd, but they are moving away at a rapid clip. Agent S narrows her eyes, and her throat is catching on every word now. She says that they stole her from her family, and the House of Stars stole her from them. Now she's stealing herself back. She puffs out her chest and theatrically discards her dark magician's outfit with a flourish, revealing a bright and multicolored witch's costume beneath. She states that her name is Sigaros Stefansdottir, not Agent S, not SCP-239, and she's going to make them wish that they try to play along with her fantasies. She then shouts, "Gatornade," and flings an object at her feet, causing it to burst and a rush of stagnant water to pour out. There are live alligators in it, and they begin snapping at the feet of the startled team. When the mist has fallen, Agent S and the House of Stars are gone, except for the leader, who leans forward to whisper in Director House's ear, whilst tickling it with the carnation, so that the entire team except for Weddle can hear him. He simply says that the House always wins, before kicking House in the shins and disappearing. The monolock hangs, suspended in the air for a moment longer, then unlocks itself and falls into the sudden swamp with a splash. Action immediately resumes, and Agent Callender leaps across the hall to pummel the alligators with periodic cries of sheer joy. Placeholder asks Sikolsky if that was part of his plan, and he just shrugs, saying that it's MC&D, what do you expect? There is another shudder in the floor, this time more violent and causing many of the rioters to be thrown to the ground, and Placeholder asks where Cimmerian is. Hishikaku shrieks, who cares, while Sikolsky shrugs again and says that he's probably fine as the team begins running. Meanwhile, Director House is being pursued through the ruins of Casino Night by the Archivist, which is screeching that they told it that House was cool and a bookie. House screams back that that isn't what a bookie is, as he trips and crashes through a chocolate waterfall. In the storage room of the Planet Fitness, Harkness is still unconscious, though the lights on the device have changed from angry red to flashing yellow. They suddenly flash red again, and he sees an abrupt intrusion on his vision, a digital representation of the Tower of Babel, which deforms into a tall, dark-skinned, androgynous figure in a flowing blue robe. It makes a shooing gesture, and Harkness's eyes suddenly snap open. At the same moment, the treadmill catches fire. He begins to scream and leaps to his feet, his helmet pulling leads out of the hole and off the burning treadmill, causing the monitor to fall to the floor with a crash. Harkness catches a glimpse of themselves in the reflection of the monitor, which doesn't help the situation. Until that moment, he hadn't noticed what was in the room with him, dozens of other Harknesses staring motionless up from the screen. The Sofants are only the construction. The Hive gives the instruction. Hive Harkness. A sound like that of a wounded animal escapes his mouth, but it doesn't feel like his mouth anymore. The remainder of the Hive buzzes like cicadas in unison. He runs towards the door and out into the blinding light. Battered, bruised, and covered in a variety of fluids, solids, and at least one type of plasma, the team reaches the portal back to the Planet Fitness, but it's shut. Weddle groans, but Sikolsky says that it's fine, as he's still got one trick up his sleeve, and he shakes out his jacket. A tiny, stoppered vial slides into his palm, with a glowing pinprick of light at the center. He unstoppers it and blows over the rim, causing a will-o'-the-wisp to dance into the air. Placeholder sighs and asks, where there's a will, there's a way? Sikolsky agrees that Agent S did love her little jokes, but the wisp strikes the wall where the way should be, spelling out a message in brilliant blue. It reads, screw you guys. None of my stuff will work for you now. Good luck. Love, Siggy. Hishikaku slaps Sikolsky on the shoulder as the shadow of the Archivist falls over them, and he says that he tried, but they can't all be geniuses. The team is led past the carnage of Casino Night, as a small, furry patron is jumping up and down on the pulverized remains of Asmodeus, which gurgles with either agony or good humor. A basketballer is wiping a variety of colorful fluids off of his boombox with his uniform, revealing a tank top underneath which reads, I got 666 problems, but my witch ain't one. The octopus is directing a small army of dazed-looking docents with brooms, to little avail, and the grand hall is gradually shrinking, its detritus vanishing into the depths of the library as the team is led into them. Director House, sporting a shredded tie and what looks like mandible marks on his ruined suit, is waiting in the archives alongside Midnight and Ball. The Archivist turns to address Sikolsky, but is interrupted by Director House, who leaps forward and punches Sikolsky in the face, although House howls in pain in response. Placeholder remarks that he expected Sikolsky to dodge that, but he just replies that he has a magic face shield from COVID and from people constantly wanting to punch him in the face. The Archivist states that they have abused the library's hospitality, with Midnight, House, and Baal agreeing, and it says that what was sacred has been profaned, and trust has been breached. Sikolsky apologizes for the whole breaking and entering bit, but they have to admit that they had it coming. They wouldn't have snuck into their top-secret lighthouse, Playhouse, if they hadn't stolen the 8-Ball. The Archivist, however, didn't even know that they broke into the lighthouse. Well, Midnight says that she did, but says that it was small potatoes. Sikolsky asks what they're talking about then, to which they all state in unison, casino night. They worked really hard on it, with Midnight even making gift bags, and House asks why they didn't just tell him they were pulling a heist, as they're on the same side, and he's the heist guy. Sikolsky replies by asking him if he would have cooperated if he'd been told, but he just says no, of course not. The Archivist asks if by the 8-Ball they mean the remains of the heroic Archivist, but Monsier replies that she doesn't think any of her friends know about that yet. Hishikaku asks Monsier how she knows something that he doesn't about the 8-Ball, and the Archivist wonders why none of them seem to know what's going on, and it really hopes that they didn't lose it. Sikolsky replies that they thought the library had it, but the Archivist says that they thought the Foundation had it. House just wonders what they're all talking about, leading to some bickering between him, Sikolsky, and Hishikaku, with Sikolsky telling House that he's not used to losing, as he has that whole catchphrase about it, and he got that thrown in his face. This leads to more bickering, with Sikolsky telling House that he was codenamed 3-Ball for the heist, because red is his color, but House is upset that he wasn't first. Weddle interrupts the arguments by asking if he needs to be here, before asking Sikolsky if he was his pick from Site 43. Sikolsky moves on, saying that they can all agree that it's a pretty big problem that they don't know where this thing is, and they should just let them go so they can figure out who has this extremely dangerous, predictive mechanism before it gets them all killed. The Archivist and Midnight both agree, however, that they'll probably be fine, and they're not going to let them go without a bribe. They decide that they'll let them go if the Foundation agrees to cover the cost of repairing everything damaged or expended during casino night, make whole all injured parties, make a substantial contribution to the Mana Charitable Foundation's Sapient Bug Emotional Trauma Fund, sponsor the next casino night without any rights of attendance, and Ball throws in that House needs to sign those forms for basketball night. Due to the urgency of the operation and the urging of Director Daniels, the combined terms were met, and the team was released. Dr. Sikolsky and Razumkhal were picked up for a high-speed flight to Site-01 the same day. During the flight, Sikolsky asks him how he's feeling, and remarks that it seems he doesn't treat his people very well. He replies that he's not sure that's fair, coming from him, and he can honestly say that Agent S, or SCP-239, or Miss Steffensdorter's time at MC&D was pleasant for all involved parties. Sikolsky asks why she betrayed him then, to which he just says that no one likes to live in a cage forever, even a gilded one with many entertaining distractions. He sighs and says that it certainly did introduce some unwelcome wrinkles to his itinerary and pocketbook, though. Sikolsky feels that he needs to interrogate him a bit here, as he was in possession of an SCP object that they had registered as neutralized. Razumkhal replies that they never intended for the Foundation to find out otherwise. Her powers were more than sufficient to occlude her identity when they met, as he was assured of beforehand, and although he was nervous about including her, she seemed very eager, and he didn't like to disappoint her. She'd been through so much disappointment because of the Foundation. He then goes into her story again, saying that they held an 8-year-old girl hostage, although Sikolsky retorts that she was an 8-year-old girl with reality-bending powers indistinguishable from magic, who could bend grown adults to her will with a flick of her mental wrist. Razumkhal then says that they authorized Dr. Clef to murder her, which Sikolsky objects to, as they use euphemisms for things they're ashamed of around here. When Clef failed, having already stolen her liberty, the Foundation stole her experience of life and time itself, putting her in a coma. Sikolsky counters by saying that it was a different, crappier world, and these days they'd just contrive something clever. There was an explosion in her cell around 2013, apparently the result of a computer virus at Site-19 combined with technician fault combined with something else, which was supposed to have obliterated her. He realizes now that the House of Stars heisted her from them and faked her death, although Hrazem Kahal says that he can't tell if he's only pretending to just now realize this. Sikolsky says that he assumes Hrazem Kahal contracted them to do this, but the demon just replies that MC&D takes no responsibility for hostile actions against its clients, and obviously, they would never take any action harming the SCP Foundation in this way. The House of Stars acquired this asset of their own volition, and having no means of removing her chemical constraints, sought a client who could, which was them. He conducted somatic negotiations with her, and she agreed to be placed under a contractual GIAS to serve the interests of MC&D in return for being restored to consciousness. Sikolsky wonders why she didn't just reality bend her way out of the coma after being told what's up, but Hrazem Kahal just says that in the realm of fantasy, we are both all-powerful and utterly powerless. He doesn't know how she avoided the GIAS with her actions, and he's upset about it as he wanted her here with them, at the end. Sikolsky just says to not jinx them though, as it's not over until it's over. Upon their arrival at Site-01, at the precise moment their credentials were confirmed by MTF Alpha-1, Sikolsky and Hrazem Kahal were met by Dr. Samarian, who was in possession of SCP-8888. Were then given his debriefing. He begins by wanting to make sure that everyone here is cleared for what he's got to say, with Janus-level clearance due to temporally sensitive info and bootstrap paradoxes. There is a pause as several individuals leave the chamber, including 058. Samarian says that most of what they know about the history of 8888 is wrong. After Sikolsky got captured, he was sure that they were about to be caught, and imagined a dozen mages wondering why they were spoiling their game night. He knew that there were measures in place to ensure security would be kept busy, even if Sikolsky wouldn't tell him precisely what those were, but after Sikolsky was captured, he figured the primary plan was shot, so they went to Plan B. He headed back out to the casino tables in the library, and was able to slip out of the underlibrary without anyone noticing thanks to Weddle's distraction. Then the security breach sensor vibrated across the whole library, and he knew that they were running out of time, so he dragged Weddle away from the game he was losing and told him to get safe. He lost track of him in the crowd not too long after that, but it didn't matter as he'd gotten what he came there for. The probability consumer they'd packed into a plastic 8-ball toy was thrumming with energy. He could feel his hair all standing on end, as it was interacting with him, exactly as they'd hoped. He wasn't just going to dodge a tree branch this time, he was going to complete the entire heist on his own. He has to admit that it was an ingenious contingency, though he'd appreciate it if that information never reached Sikolsky's ears. He asked the ball a simple question, where is the target, and it gave him back an answer that is not possible on the standard toy, follow your instincts. After that, it was bedlam on the casino floor, as the reversal of fortunes was not pretty. Under Vegas, security already thought that everyone was cheating, and now the players thought the library was cheating them by stealing their luck. He took an alternate route into the underlibrary in the chaos, using Hishikaku's card as he'd been instructed to. 8 doors and 6 hallways later, he was in the adjunct pipe distribution section of the underlibrary. The place was pitch black, and he was navigating literally on instinct. It wasn't long before he saw it, a temporal tear in the middle of a stone wall big enough for a man to pass through, with just a bit of flickering light. 057 interrupts the story to ask if Samarian's anomalous luck allowed him to find this alternate target using a magic 8-ball. Samarian confirms that's the case, although it was a particularly magic 8-ball, He could see the aperture to the other side, and lying there on the ground, just past the threshold, was the target. So he did what any reasonable man would do in the situation and jumped through. 054 asks why he didn't just immediately return through the aperture once he had the anomaly. Cimmerian replies that at first it was because he saw two library mages running full tilt at the temporal rift, but before he could even weigh his options, the tear closed and he was back in the dark. He had no idea where he was, so he started exploring as much as he could. It seemed like he'd ended up exactly in the same place, inside the library, at least from the size of the room and the material of the walls and floor, but there weren't any pipes. He kept exploring until he found his way out, and he popped out into an open and musty-smelling library, but the smell of smoke overpowered that pretty much immediately. 059 remarks on Cimmerian mentioning bootstrap paradoxes, and asks if he traveled back in time to 1993. Cimmerian replies that he didn't come out of the anomaly in 1993, or in the current iteration of the library. They'll recall that the Underlibrary is a composite of famous and important repositories of knowledge throughout history. The Wanderers grabbed those sections at various points in time prior to their destruction, in order to prevent the irreversible loss of knowledge. This was why a temporal tear was present in that location, though he had no idea at the time why anyone would place the 8-ball on the other side of one of those tears. Eventually, he figured out where he was, and when. 48 BCE, Alexandria, Egypt. An alert then sounds on the desk of each of the overseers still present, and 054 says that they're going to have to pause this. They ask Cimmerian who he left the anomaly with. Cimmerian replies that he left it at the anomaly intake department in Sector G, but 054 says that Sector G just had an unauthorized teleport, and they can't find the object. During Cimmerian's interview, a cascade DDoS attack was performed on the servers of both Site-01 and its compensatory backups at Site-15 by an anomalous electronic agent with forged network credentials. Despite a heavy presence of MTF Alpha-1 on site, security patrols were apparently circumvented to allow multiple hostile individuals free access to Sector G during the interval before control was reasserted. Intake personnel were quickly swamped by a vast herd of chickens with elongated legs and vast pillowed undersides coated in a soporific fluid which rapidly induced unconsciousness. The magic 8-ball Cimmerian had utilized in his successful recovery of 8888 was removed from containment by an intruder, who was apparently able to manifest the same tycho-kinetic powers Cimmerian himself possesses, and employed it to locate 8888. The intruders then acquired the object and demanifested from its chamber, leaving behind only a black felt top hat and a single yellow carnation. Sikolsky immediately began a debriefing of the demon, Hrazem Kahl. Hrazem Kahl says that he's sure Sikolsky has already figured it out, and asks if he needs to hear it from him. Sikolsky says that Agent S was able to let the house heist her from MC&D because she intended to offer them the house's services, stealing the 8-ball from Site-01. Hrazem Kahl claps in response and says that the original plan was for her to accompany Sikolsky and him here and perform the service. Her counteroffer fulfilled the same criteria, so he accepted. Sikolsky guesses that the house's payment was releasing her from the Gias, and Hrazem Kahl confirms that that is what he told them to ask him for. Sikolsky fixes him with a sour expression for several seconds before asking if she's free then. The demon replies that she has her agency and is already exercising it. He suggests that they strengthen security measures across the board. Sikolsky just remarks that she did all this to join the House of Stars, and asks if Hrazem Kahl defaulted on a contract just to do something nice for his pet reality bender. He replies that they defaulted on nothing, as they had a pre-existing contract which took precedence, and he assures Sikolsky that the terms they outlined will be honored in due course. Sikolsky just says that he'll excuse him if he doesn't stand around taking his word on that. He then adds that this was beneath Hrazem Kahl, but he expected this, and has had an MTF waiting at his facility for the last 24 hours. Hrazem Kahl says that he didn't think Sikolsky knew about that, but Sikolsky is then contacted by the MTF, who tell him that they're at the vault. It was already open, though, and there's nothing in it. Sikolsky, however, insists that it's in there. It just might be thaumaturgically masked, or under a nanite stealth cloak, or it might be floating in half space. Hrazem Kahl, however, tells him that he's afraid that it isn't in there. Sikolsky replies that he literally cannot have it anywhere else. That vault was constructed to the specs required to keep the 8-Ball inside, and it's the only such vault he has. The Foundation scryed and found that vault, and didn't find any others, not from any other group of interest either. It's not in transit, because nothing that can transit it could hold it this long. He stands and begins to shout. He yells that unless they blew it up, or stuck it in an Eigen machine and let it ascend to Godhead, or it joined the House of Stars to go on a heist rampage through time and space, he put that ball in that vault, and he's going to get it back. He then stops, as if realizing something, and sits down again, asking the agent if they got that. Hrazem Kahl apologizes, saying that he should have told him sooner, as he didn't know he'd get angry. Sikolsky replies that he didn't know he could, but asks the demon where he's socked it away, or he guesses they'll kill them all or something, as he's written plans. The demon leans over and pats him on the shoulder, saying that he's sure he has. Sikolsky repeats his question, asking where it's contained. Hrazem Kahl simply replies with, "It isn't," and then pauses, asking if he heard that. Sikolsky replies that of course he heard that, but what does that mean? Semantically, it would have to mean it isn't contained, but that's obviously not what he said. And then he realizes what Hrazem Kahl said before about a pre-existing contract. He realizes that he doesn't mean the House of Stars, and comes to a further realization. He asks the demon to confirm that he just sold it, or asked it to find lost Spanish gold, or something else stupid, but Hrazem Kahl says no, and smiles. He told him at the start that Marshal Carter and Dark always honor their commitments, as it's the only way to do business. After a pause, Sikolsky just says, "Well played," but he wasn't talking to the demon. After further debriefing, Cimmerian resumed his investigation of Hishikaku, now possessed of a catastrophically damning wealth of cross-observed historical data and personal experiences to draw upon. Hishikaku was subsequently found guilty of a number of serious offenses, including, but by no means limited to, forging an overseer-level access keycard to augment his own credentials, unauthorized use of SCP-2140 for that purpose, occupying the overseer-only penthouse visitation suite at Site 15, abusing his authority over the course of his directorship to improve said suite's amenities to a degree Cimmerian has characterized as obscene and transcendent of the bounds of good taste, engaging with an underground crime ring operating in the Wanderer's Library, accepting a bribe in return for assisting a time-traveling Cimmerian to steal 8888 from Site 15, although Cimmerian has successfully argued that his actions were carried out to preserve the proper course of history. Various acts of petty sabotage attempted against the team during Operation Pickpocket, each easily thwarted by the team, with special emphasis on the foresight of Sikolsky, and cheating in a game of chance played against Professor Crow in the staff commons of Residence Wing B at Site 15. He has accordingly been removed from his post with prejudice, and the matter of his final disposition is before the Overseer Council at present. Researcher Harkness's proposals that Hishikaku be demoted to the rank of Technician 3rd Class and employed as technical support for either Observation Site 211 or the Planet Fitness Outpost in North Palm Beach, Florida, are reportedly under serious consideration. cite 666's exclusion from Etra's disastrous intervention in Casino Night allowed Director House to retain much of the goodwill previously generated between its three planning parties, and it further transpired that he had taken out a speculative insurance policy with Goldbaker Rhines on the event's gaming machines and paraphernalia, which paid off 2-1 against his initial investment, unchallenged by the insurer due to his near-total non-complicity in the damage. He successfully argued with the Department of Financial Esoterica that his hosting obligations for the upcoming basketball night event justified the expenditure of these funds on expansion of Site-666's plant and equipment. As one element of the complex renegotiations between the Foundation, the Wanderer's Library, UnderVegas, and MC&D, the Serpent's Hand provided a copy of a previously uncatalogued document to Etra. It apparently manifested on a shelf in the non-fiction section, where it was discovered by docents engaged in the ongoing cleanup efforts after Casino Night. The document appears to be a film script, the contents of which have been used to populate this temporary file ahead of its recompilation by 052. The script takes a variety of perspectives, ranging from personal to impersonal to omniscient, and ends with a single piece of painted storyboard art depicting the events of its final scene. Due to the accuracy of the preceding narrative, recovery agents were dispatched to the supposed filming location post-haste, but no sign of the subject was found, save for a small impact crater. The document is entitled Empty Pockets, the unconditionally, infallibly, comprehensively true story of SCP-8888. It is attributed to SCP-8888 itself. At a beach on the island of Antikythera in Greece, we're given the final scene of the story. The shot opens on a vibrant sky, as a serene Mediterranean sunset fills the upper half of the frame, with crystal blue sea below. Atmosphere blurs the air above the horizon, rendering the distant mountain ranges faint silhouettes. The outline of an albatross is barely visible, beating its amber-lit wings against the mist, soaring into obscurity. The camera pans down while remaining focused on the horizon, and the sun appears to rise slightly higher into the sky. Eventually, a dark, matte black sphere comes into frame, etched with ornate sigils and a large amber arrow. The ball is surrounded by the cracked fragments of a gold, truncated octahedral frame. A thin fuchsia umbrella towers over the relic, shading it in a nearby beach chair. A porthole's upper edge is barely visible on the sphere's far side, pointed into the reddening sunset. A woman in a gaudy witch's dress, holding a large, outdated brick cell phone on a silver platter, approaches the sphere and pats it affectionately before pointing to the phone and saying, "It's for you." The voice on the other end belongs to Jin Larry Viridian, manager of the SCP Foundation's account with the Goldbaker Rhines Insurance Group. He says that he's sorry to interrupt its fun in the sun, but they thought it best to put a bow on everything ASAP. He's sure that it understands, and Miss Stefan's daughter kindly volunteered to bring it this token of their esteem. The witch, beaming fit to challenge the sun, places a briefcase in the sand beside the sphere's impact crater. She opens it, revealing it to be packed full of physically transmogrified silver Numa coins. Viridian continues, saying that obviously it understands that this is merely a gift, and in no way should it be taken as compensation for its role in raising the insurance premiums they levy on one of their primary clients. None of them at Goldbaker Rhines are ever eager to shortchange a client. The witch examines the driftwood table that sits within arm's reach of the sphere, though, of course, it lacks arms. A modest array of trophies is already present. A beautiful crystal bottle in the form of an hourglass, a weathered holographic Ace of Diamonds playing card, and a small cup of miniature parasol umbrellas. The witch scoops up a portion of Numacoin, sufficient to bankroll any number of stochastic schemes, and adds them to the symbolic haul. A low humming sound begins deep in the bowels of the sphere, and the voice on the phone seems to comprehend its import. He says that it's more than welcome, to keep Goldbaker Rhines in mind for all of its future-proof endeavors, and to enjoy the rest of its evening. The sphere seems to contemplate the far horizon, the endlessly complex yet compassable harmony of the spheres which paint the sky and shroud the earth in dark with clockwork precision. The witch snaps her fingers and places a gaudy drink on the table in the last remaining space amongst the spoils. It's a Mai Tai, with citrus fruit slices pierced by an oversized green crazy straw tied into a figure eight. She winks and says that it's on the house, with no need for her to clarify. She places her hand on the sphere again, and the humming changes pitch and rises in volume as they consider the close of the day together. It's not precisely a happy hum, but the only soul present to feel it can feel a tiny kernel of something like satisfied contentment at its uttermost core. All's well that ends well, then, for most parties involved. The story here is a bit tricky to follow, as it's not told in order and involves time travel, which always makes things a little more obtuse. I'm actually going to go ahead and quote one of the authors here, Harry Blank, to better explain what exactly went down between the Eight Ball and Cimmerian. While he's interrupted before he can explain completely, Dr. Cimmerian reveals to the overseers that he's been engaged in a lengthy series of time-traveling shenanigans to ensure that the events of the heist play out as they should. His magic Eight Ball and luck anomaly led him to a rift in the Underlibrary, through which he could see his target, SCP-8888, and he passed through to acquire it. Instead of ending up in an earlier version of the library's vault, as he expected, he instead finds himself in the burning Library of Alexandria in 48 BCE. All libraries are connected to the Wanderer's Library, after all. It's implied at this point that Cimmerian encounters the Eight Ball in its long past form, where it is being used by the ancient Greeks, and from this point on, he shepherds it through the known series of events that will ensure it ends up in Foundation control. In an earlier segment, written from the Eight Ball's perspective, where it sits on the deck of Hero of Alexandria's ship as it prepares to set sail for a journey that will end in its sinking to the bottom of the sea, a mysterious figure on the dock is seen. This is Cimmerian, ensuring that the ship does sink so that the device's remains can be recovered and eventually acquired by the Foundation, creating the present-day version of Eight Ball. Further implication suggests that Cimmerian continues to travel through time. Hundreds of years later, he is one of the figures who steals the Eight Ball from Site 15, thus triggering Sokolsky's heist, which itself triggers Cimmerian's voyage into the past in the first place, creating a time loop. With the Eight Ball in his possession again, and presumably with access to its advice, he makes further trips through time to ensure that it's present wherever it needs to be for the time loop to be stable. It's possible he even uses it to lure himself through the time rift in the first place, though the article doesn't state this outright. However the sequence plays out, it ends with him presenting the overseers with the version of SCP-8888 that disappeared from the Wanderer's Library vault long before Sokolsky's heist opened it, at which point he believes the heist is finally complete. To summarize that summary, then, Cimmerian had to go through time multiple times to ensure that no paradoxes occurred with the Eight Ball, as the Foundation created the Eight Ball from the Eight Ball itself after it was sent back in time and ended up in the ocean. Part of this involved him being one of the individuals that stole the Eight Ball from the Foundation at the start, but his plan sort of ends with him bringing the Eight Ball back to the Foundation. What he wasn't aware of, however, was that the Eight Ball had a plan of its own, to actually escape from containment and finally be free. The Eight Ball had orchestrated the entire thing, including its capture and release by the House of Stars at the end, allowing it to just spend some time on a beach for a bit with Agent S. This is what Sokolsky and Hrazem Kahl are referring to in their last conversation, as part of the Eight Ball's plan involved having a contract with MC&D in order to have the House of Stars steal it from the Foundation. It's certainly a complicated plot, but in the end, both the 8-Ball and Agent S are finally free from being told what to do by people and organizations. We of course get to know all this because the 8-Ball went ahead and wrote an omniscient film script of the whole thing, which we know to be 100% true, as it can't write fiction, since fiction is lying. It's hard to say how much this will all affect the Foundation, since they seemed to depend on it quite heavily, but now I guess it's a bit more of a level playing field. Overall, I'd say the individuals, or objects, that won in the end probably deserved their victory, just like any good heist movie.